and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, an historic housing shortage nationally and locally. We chat with the Sullivan County Land Bank about efforts to create affordable housing. Incarcerated, WJFF's Patricia Rubio brings us a COVID lockdown story from inside the Sullivan County Correctional Facility. Who gets grandma's yellow pie plate? We'll learn about the guide to help families deal with inheritance issues. Plus, cooking in the Catskills, Chef Brett August talks with the brothers behind Benji and Jake's Pizza in Kaneoga Lake. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has updated its pandemic guidelines to acknowledge that the coronavirus is an airborne virus, saying the most common form of transmission is by inhaling the respiratory fluids at close range of others. The CDC says the way to protect yourself, though, has not changed, including the use of masks, social distancing, and vaccines. Central Florida theme parks are altering their coronavirus safety measures as the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention evolves. Talia Blake of member station WMFE reports on Universal and Walt Disney World.
Both Universal Orlando and Disney World reopened last summer, requiring temperature checks for guests. Universal Orlando now says it no longer requires temperature checks as guests enter the park. Disney will begin phasing out the checks for cast members beginning today, May 8th, and for guests May 16th. Both companies say they are following guidance from health and government officials. Earlier this week, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed an executive order lifting local rules requiring mask wearing and social distancing. Universal has also dropped social distancing to 3 feet, while Disney remains at 6 feet. For NPR News, I'm Talia Blake.
Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz found a warm welcome last night in the Villages, a retirement community in Florida just north of Orlando. They were there for the kickoff of their America First tour. Joe Burns of member station WMFA reports.
It was like a mini Trump rally in a hotel ballroom. The MAGA hats, the rock and roll music, the USA chants, and the taunting of the media. Congresswoman Greene spoke first.
Tell me, who is your president? That's my president, too. Okay.
Then Congressman Gaetz, who was under federal investigation over allegedly violating sex trafficking laws.
I'm a canceled man in some corners of the internet. I might be a wanted man by the deep state, but I am a Florida man, and it is good to be home.
Then they got together on the stage and attacked the Democrats and Republicans less loyal to Trump. Further details on the rest of the tour were not disclosed. For NPR News, I'm Joe Burns in the Villages, Florida.
The Pentagon has deployed a dozen additional warplanes to bolster protection of American and coalition troops, making a final withdrawal from Afghanistan as fighting with Taliban insurgents has increased. The BBC's Jill McGivern reports the Afghan security forces have launched a counteroffensive against the Taliban.
This is the fourth day of heavy fighting in Baghlan. It's one of half a dozen provinces currently reporting violence. This is a period of intense uncertainty for Afghanistan. US-led troops have started to withdraw, raising concerns of a power vacuum and fears the conflict will worsen. On Friday, Taliban representatives held an online meeting with officials from the US, the UN, the EU and several European countries about resuming stalled peace talks.
This is NPR. Secretary of State Antony Blinken exchanged barbs with his counterparts from China and Russia at a high-level United Nations Security Council virtual meeting on multilateral cooperation and addressing global threats. Linda Fasulo reports on the session chaired by China, which serves as president of the council for the month of May.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. will abide by international commitments and rules and work together with other nations, including those with which it has serious differences, in order to resolve global crises. But in an apparent reference to Russia and China, he stated the U.S. would, quote, push back forcefully against countries that undermine the international order. And Blinken stressed that the U.S. rejects the view that any nation is entitled to a sphere of influence where it can dictate decisions to another country. In veiled mentions of the U.S., Russia and China both criticized its use of unilateral sanctions. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
Remnants of a huge Chinese rocket launched last week are expected to fall back through the atmosphere this weekend. China says most of the debris should burn up upon re-entry. The U.S. military, though, calls it an uncontrolled re-entry, and there is some concern that debris could come down over land, although experts say it's more likely to splash down in the ocean. U.S. Space Command is tracking the rocket ahead of its return, but says pinpointing exactly where it will end up is difficult. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Human Factor, a new documentary by Jor Moret, director of The Gatekeepers, about the U.S.'s 30-year effort to secure peace in the Middle East, now playing.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The extreme shortage of homes for sale nationally reached a new low in April, according to Redfin Real Estate Brokerage. But strength in the construction of newly built homes may ease the pain for some homebuyers in some markets. However, locally, residents are struggling to find housing in Sullivan County. The Sullivan County Land Bank is trying to ease this shortage. I spoke with Executive Director Jill Weyer about the Land Bank's efforts to create new homes and to keep folks informed about expiring eviction moratoriums.
There are rules out there of you know, you want to pay your taxes and you know, you have to follow those rules, but there are moratoriums in place for those people who are experiencing hardships, that they want to show that they have a need, that they can't pay their taxes, they can't pay their mortgages. So, you know, what can we do? So we want to make sure people know that there are steps in place that they can get help or seek, you know, assistance to make sure that they don't lose their homes.
In addition to the moratoriums ending, there's a housing shortage. There's an article in the Democrat recently that says the struggle to find housing. Affordable housing has long been an issue here in Sullivan County, but the Land Bank is here to help address that. Can you talk a little bit about the shortage of housing?
So there's a quality issue and a quantity issue with housing in Sullivan County. While the Land Bank focuses in the villages of Monticello and Liberty, we really haven't had any new construction of homes since the 60s. So the quality of those homes are starting to degrade. And so those houses, any of the good houses, are being snapped up quickly, and they're going for a good rate. So people who are moving out of the city or escaping from the city are buying up those homes. So the affordability is gone. So the hope is that the Land Bank is here to help assist those homeowners or renters who are living here in Sullivan County who want to now move into a home. So the Land Bank is working on selling homes that need some renovation, that we can work with the homeowner to renovate the home and sell it at a reduced rate. And so that's a possibility. And then the Land Bank is also currently building three new homes. We're building two in Liberty and one in Monticello. And so we'll build those homes at a loss that will need to be heavily subsidized, because we want to make sure that they're affordable for a homeowner. So, you know, right now construction costs are going up, but we are committed to building these homes and then selling them at an affordable rate to people who meet the income requirements so that they can buy a house affordably in the community.
It's telling that you're willing to take a loss in order to get that quality of housing stock up.
Right. Right now, there aren't any, well, I shouldn't say aren't any, but there are less incentives for homeowners. Most of the state programs are really for more rental assistance. So there is some new legislation coming in that hopefully will be passed that will give new homeowner tax credits similar to the rental tax credits that are existing. So otherwise, we are really subsidizing this new construction with money that we've gotten through the Community Revitalization Initiative, which is money passed through from the AG's office. We're using AHC, which is affordable housing funding from the state. We have a CDBG grant at the county that's subsidizing it, and then also the Sunny May Neighborhood Revitalization Program. So we're trying to layer all of these incentives or funding sources to help buy down the cost of the construction to make sure that the home is affordable to a new homeowner.
And we all know in the upstate region that due to the pandemic, many folks fled New York City and other areas for, wide open spaces. How does that impact your efforts with the hot housing market?
Right. Like, we've been getting some of the homes that we do have on the market right now through the land bank. People, want to buy it, sight unseen, cash on, hand. And we're like, well, the intent of the land bank is, to sell for the best use, to make sure we are getting affordable home ownership to people who, live in the community that need this opportunity. So to us, while cash is great, that's not really what we're after. And so we really are looking for the perfect person to purchase this home and make the community their home, that they'll live there. Typically, our grants have a requirement of between 5 and 10 years that you'll live in the home, be vested in the community, and you're not really flipping the home.
Are more properties being used for short-term visits and not long-term living situations and therefore impacting the regular rental market?
We're seeing that in outside of the villages more, that, the people are, the investors who are owning the homes are able to get a better rate for like an Airbnb or a short-term rental versus renting it to a tenant full-time. And right now, given that, there is that moratorium on the evictions, unfortunately, people aren't paying rents. And so then the investors aren't getting any income. So a short-term rental to them is a better deal. And so unfortunately, that creates a lack of affordable housing for the rental market.
What are some of the benefits that affordable housing brings to a community?
So it would build community. You are more invested. If you own your home, you have a better chance of being committed to that neighborhood, to upkeeping the house, to taking care and to, monitoring your neighbors and really being vested. It helps you to build your own wealth. And so just by having people purchase a home and live there, they are more committed. Right now in our villages, it's roughly 60 to 70% renter occupied. So we're losing that home ownership base. So we really like to get that number up so that there are more people committed to, raising their families and growing up in the communities.
And you are returning properties to productive use. Where do you stand now? How many properties are currently that you own or you're trying to sell? Does it feel like it's a healthy stock for you now?
So we haven't acquired many properties in the last few years just because of COVID and the moratorium and how the foreclosure process has worked. Because the main means of how the land bank acquires properties is through the foreclosing governmental unit. So we really get most of our homes from the tax foreclosure, from the county or from the villages tax foreclosures. So because that's kind of been wonky now through COVID, we haven't acquired any properties that way. But we've roughly got about 60 properties overall that we had in the land bank inventory. We've sold approximately 10 either new homes or side lot sales, because we've demolished approximately 25 bladed structures in the villages of Monticello and Liberty. And so now those lots were either selling to the site owner to expand their property or in the case, building new homes on them.
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but how are you feeling about things moving forward as we emerge from lockdown, the future of the affordable housing that you're working on?
I'm optimistic. I think now with COVID releasing or relaxing, there'll be more funding available for housing initiatives. There is new legislation coming out for rebuilding communities that will have funding available. So I'm optimistic the county and the land bank will work together to really start to build up our housing stock and get more affordability out there so people are able to take advantage of that, whether it's as a homeowner or as a renter, that will be able to have that stock available.
If someone's in need of housing assistance, how can they get a hold of the land bank, and what things would you be able to offer?
Right. So the land bank really is kind of the vehicle to access properties or the homes. Again, we really focus on acquiring the blighted, vacant, abandoned properties, and then we work with other housing organizations. Right now we're working with REPCO, which is a housing organization that works in the Hudson Valley, and they kind of offer that housing counseling and identifying programs, whether it's Sunny May or whether it's USDA, to see what programs a homeowner might be eligible. And then, you know, counseling them through it. So is it a credit issue that you need to correct and what you need to do? So really, if somebody is interested in working with the land bank, they would contact us, but then we would also refer them to other housing agencies to kind of help you make sure you're housing ready and that you're able to purchase a home and that you have the means to do it and the commitment to do it, because we don't want to put you in a house that you can't afford or that you can't take care of. So we want to make sure you have the tools needed to make that sustaining.
And what about builders or developers or other home specialists? Do you work with those contractors as well?
Yes, we are always looking for developers. You know, we have some larger properties that we have in the land bank. We have the Spanish Castle in Liberty, which is an old three-family home that was built, you know, way back in the early 1900s. That's a really amazing building that we're looking to renovate and rehabilitate. So we're looking for a developer for that. Right now we are working with other developers on the old Monticello Manor in Monticello on High Street, the old hospital, looking to renovate that into affordable housing. And then we're partnering the Monticello Manor project with a Broadway project. So we've acquired 430 Broadway, which is the Strong building. And then we have an option to purchase the Key Bank building, which is on Broadway and Bank Street. So between those two, we're trying to get mixed-use development, get affordable housing on the upper stories, commercial on the bottom, and we hope that that'll start to reinvigorate the downtown and get more activity and start to stimulate more development as well.
And do you consider property donations if someone wanted to donate property to the land bank?
Yes. Right now we are working with the town of Liberty on a property that a private landowner is donating to the land bank to use for a downtown project that the town of Liberty is working on in Parksville. So we would really look to identify the type of property it is. We don't want to just take any property. We want to make sure that there is an end use in mind. So actually we're working with Sullivan Arc as well. They're donating 4 vacant lots that we hope to build homes on. And so we're trying to just work with all of our partners and any people who are interested in furthering our mission. So if they have properties that would benefit the community, we would definitely review them. We just worked on a project last summer with the Center for Workforce Development Summer Youth Interns, and we developed in the village of Monticello at the end of Edward and Bailey Avenues. We received a property donation of a bunch of vacant lots, and so we were able to do an outdoor trail with an outdoor classroom, and the summer youth kind of created the trail that is now open to the public so people can go out and use this outdoor space. So that was a great donation that we received from a landowner.
We've been speaking with Jill Weyer, the executive director of the Sullivan County Land Bank, also the Deputy Commissioner of Sullivan County Division of Planning. More information about the Land Bank's mission at sullivancountylandbank.org. Jill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with the prison journalist writing from inside the Sullivan Correctional Facility. This is Radio Chatskill.
When I was a kid, my extended family used to do road trips across the Midwest. Hi, this is Ari Shapiro. Because this was in pre-cell phone days, we had CB radios. I was a kid with dreams of being an actor when I grew up. And so we all had code names on these CB radios, and my code name was Waiter. Because even as a young kid, I knew that being an actor really meant being a waiter. Let your car take one last road trip. Donate it now.
Go to WJFFradio.org.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Helen Hong told us why she's going to wait till the pandemic is over to start dating again.
I am so sick of, like, hitting on dudes who look really hot from the mask up, and then they pull the mask off, and it's like, yikes!
I'm Peter Sagal. We'll never disappoint you that way, because you can't see us. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. John J. Lennon is a journalist and a prisoner serving a life sentence at the Sullivan Correctional Facility. Lennon has worked as a freelance journalist for The Atlantic, Esquire, The Marshall Project, and more. He recently wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about life inside the Sullivan Correctional Facility during the pandemic. He has no computer and no direct access to the internet or email. He's permitted to make calls only during certain hours of the day to a pre-approved list. WJFF's Patricio Rubio spoke with Lennon about life inside a penitentiary. It's an excerpt from our local edition podcast, which debuts today on WJFFradio.org.
John J. Lennon is a contributing writer for the Marshall Project, a contributing editor at Esquire, an advisor to the Prison Journalism Project. He is serving an aggregate sentence of 28 years to life at Sullivan Correctional Facility in New York for murder, drug sales, and gun possession. But he is also the finalist for the 2019 National Magazine Award in Feature Writing, and he recently wrote an article for the New York Times entitled, "I Am Incarcerated. This is my COVID lockdown story," a look into what it was like to be in prison during the pandemic. I wanted to speak to John to see what was life like working as a journalist inside a prison and how he got into writing in the first place. Yes, John's an active writer, writing behind the concrete walls and barbed wire fences.
Jewel at New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
To accept charges, press 1. To report charges, thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hello.
I first asked John, what was the genesis of the article and why he wanted to share his experience inside the prison?
Yeah, I mean, journalistically speaking, I mean, that's the like peg out there right now, right? It's, you know, It's the story that everyone's reading about. It's, you know, what's life like in the, you know, the era of COVID. And I've been writing about it, as you mentioned, for the past year. I was in Sing Sing when it first crept into Sing Sing, which is an older prison on the Hudson. And I covered it for Esquire. I wrote several articles about it. And as you mentioned, it was difficult, to be fair, for corrections to sort of wrap their head around how they were going to sort of keep us safe. So it was a little more intense when I was in Sing Sing. About 5 people died, 4 prisoners, 1 corrections officer. It's an old prison. We live on top of each other. So when I got to, so I wrote about that. I'm sorry, it was just the officer here. They're just checking. I'm in the yard just to set the scene for the listeners. on a phone, you know, guys are jogging. It's a brisk night, you know, sunny tower in the distance. So when I started writing about this back in Sing Sing, you know, it was the response was uh, uh, it was officers, and you know, Docs was having a difficult time, as I mentioned. And then it quelled. It kind of ran its way through Sing Sing, as I mentioned. There was deaths, and then it sort of it quelled for a bit, and then the summer came, and I was transferred out, and I was transferred to a smaller prison here in the Catskills, Sullivan. And you know, COVID, the coronavirus hadn't quite really reached its way to the northern prisons yet. So, to your question, the sort of genesis of, or the reason for writing this, it's all about, you know, I had a colleague that was working at the New York Times Magazine, and they were looking for pieces on, you know, on COVID. It's all networking, this freelance business. So it was basically, you know, it had hit Sullivan in the second wave had come, and they sort of locked the cell block down. At this point, to be fair to corrections too, they kind of had their acts together with PPE, and they had a plan for when the second wave was going to hit. But the piece was basically just about the 30-day lockdown in the cell block, and what's it like for guys living in a cell block when COVID comes, and you have a cast of characters, and you tell your tale.
The one thing that I took away from your article that was I wasn't expecting to, obviously the life you're living in prison is very different from anybody who's experiencing COVID outside the prison. But what it was struck me was that it was sort of a lot of the same things that you were experiencing there was happening in the outside, as far as scrambling for masks, the fear. You talked about the fear of this virus and who's contracting it, and how your other prison mates were getting sick, and you were nervous. You were talking to your mother, encouraging her to get it. Obviously, it's set in the prison setting, so it is different. But I what I took away from was a lot of the things were the same that a lot of people were experiencing out here, sort of the same sort of themes.
Sure, yeah. Look, people are people, you know. I mean, we're locked down. You guys are locked down. Even my editors, while writing this piece, and, you know, they were asking me, like, do you feel a certain way about this lockdown that's so ubiquitous now? Everyone's saying lockdown, lockdown. And, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, it wasn't like we in here are sort of resentful to you out there because you guys use the word lockdown. We get it. It's a scary time right now. It's not like we're like gripping the bars and, you know, telling the world you guys don't know about this real lockdown. I mean, it's just, you know, we have fear. We get anxious. We make jokes. We have fun. People are people. Some of us, you know, committed some terrible crimes. Everyone's got their own story. You know, everyone's trying to overcome whatever they did. Some people did some terrible things out there, and the worst thing that they did is not really known. You know, we're people in prison, but people are people. So, I mean, when you tell stories about characters, I try to, you know, humanize, you know, my peers, but it's kind of easy, you know, because, you know, I know the different facets of the characters that I'm around.
Now, you began writing in prison, and I was reading about the Columbia Journalism Review article that came out about you, about how you got into writing. And for the listeners who want to see that, you could visit their website at cjr.org. You started writing in prison after taking a creative writing class. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was back in 2010. At that point, I was in Attica. I was about 9 years into my sentence. The first couple of years, you don't know what the hell to do with yourself in prison. You kind of find yourself. You try to find yourself. There's not much opportunities going on in prison. There's a lot of incapacitation and just nothingness. TVs in the cells. A lot of politicking in the yard, and it's really tough for guys to sort of find some type of something to sort of do with their lives, frankly. And by 2010, I was in Attica. And Attica's a pretty rough joint, but there was a little glimmer of hope in Attica. There's always pockets of rehabilitation in prison, even in the worst of prisons. And that was you know, I was fortunate to find that creative writing workshop. And in prison, whenever there's something good going on, it's not like everyone's saying, hey, there's something good going on. You guys gotta get down with this. And everyone, like, keeps it to themselves. And I was just fortunate that somebody, like, invited me to that workshop, one of the guys that was there. And this guy, Doran Larson, he's an English professor, and he was coming in teaching. He, you know, he just showed us what good writing looked like. You know, we read Best American Essays, and, you know, I saw where these pieces were published, and I was like, wow, this is the real deal right here. The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Magazine, New York Times Magazine. Like, these are the holy grails. Like, this is, I remember telling him, I was like, well, I want to send my stuff there. Like, how do I, you know, and he kind of looked at me like, well, you know, let's just focus on the task at hand right now. But yeah, it was that's where I learned how to write. He showed us what good writing looked like.
Now, did you have any experience or any kind of artistic endeavor before prison, any capacity?
No. I came to prison like with a ninth grade education. I was just a drug dealer I grew up in a housing project. My mother kind of wanted the best for me. She sent me to different schools or whatever, but, you know, I had my own, I screwed up, you know, I had this void, and my father killed himself, all that kind of stuff. And I went out looking for this kind of lifestyle, and it was, the lifestyle at that point was very attractive to me. I grew up in Brooklyn. We moved to Hell's Kitchen, and I hung out with a crew of kids that I thought were really cool. And, you know, I became a criminal, and, you know, I got everything that life had to offer, including 28 years to life. So by the time I came to prison, you know, I was kind of like a high school dropout. I had like a ninth grade education. I always loved story. I didn't realize how complicated it was to tell those stories. But when I sort of got into that workshop at Attica, that was like the first time I got to sort of like, learn what it entailed. And, you know, that's kind of,
yeah, and as a writer myself, as a reporter, writing is not easy. It's not the easiest thing sometimes. You know, you have so many words in your head and to get it on paper, and then, you know, it's a really rough draft in the beginning, and then it's just a whole bunch of revisions after that. When I was reading this, first thing is, how long did it take you to write this article, and how did you write this article? I think in the Columbia article, it mentions that you do have access to a typewriter. Was that always the case? Were you always writing on the typewriter, or were you handwriting it and submitting it, or what was that process like?
You know, so back when I was, you know, freelancing articles in the beginning, like my first piece I published when I was at Attica in 2013, you know, I mean, it took months to write that first sort of op-ed. I first got published in The Atlantic, and I mean, it's just very hard. It was just I could probably whip up a piece like that, you know, much quicker. I mean, I'm working on a piece right now for the Times, another op-ed, but it's, you know, it gets easier, but it's always hard, right? But to answer your question about the logistics, yeah, I mean, you in the beginning, you don't have any network, you know, you may have a girlfriend that, you know, that may be annoyed that you're asking to, like, you know, like email some editor that you don't know, and it's tough to sort of get this network from prison. But landing pieces from prison is about building relationships too, and it's not, that's just any freelancer can relate to that. But to answer your question, like, yeah, I mean, I write initially on my typewriter, and then, you know, when I didn't have contacts, I would, you know, sort of blind submit, finger scroll down mastheads of different magazines and go for it. That first clip I had in The Atlantic kind of helped me because, you know, maybe it opened editors, it raised the eyebrows of editors, like, wow, this bum was published in The Atlantic, he may be able to write something. Like, so it kind of, like, the clips kind of help you. But with this, but fast forward to 2021, with the New York Times Magazine piece, I mean, it was on a serious deadline. You know, the characters were, I have JPay now too. So JPay helps me. It's a tablet that, not a really popular, company because they profit off of prisoners, and people aren't too thrilled about that. But, you know, it's an added way of communicating with our loved ones. I use it for both. I communicate with my editors and my loved ones, and it allows me to cut and paste and to send manuscripts to my editors. So to answer your question, I thumbtapped that 5,000-word piece in the New York Times Magazine on my little JPEG tablet, and I went back and forth for a couple of months with my editor about, I don't know, maybe 10 drafts, and it was pretty intense.
No, it's like I say, it's a powerful piece, and it gives great insight of what happens, what's life like in the prison. You writing, I'm sure it helps your time in prison. It gives you something to do. It gives you, you know, I guess a reason to do something during the day. This is what I take from it. This is what I imagine from a person who's in the outside who's reading this and looking at your history and seeing this and say, wow, like, this is his thing. And this is what keeps him busy and he sort of keeps him alive mentally and your soul in prison. Am I wrong in that? Or
yeah, I would say all of the above. You know, I'm incredibly grateful for this career that I've built for myself. But I would say it's a career. You know, I earn income. I write stories. You know, I'm a contributor, you know, to Esquire and to these places, and I've been fortunate to build a career for myself. So it's about identity too. Like it's 720. So like, and I remember in a piece last year or year and a half ago I wrote, it was more of a reckoning sort of piece I wrote for the Washington Post magazine, and it was trying to come to terms with my crime. And, you know, when you write a personal essay about that, you know, it's about identity, you know, and I was writing it from a place where I had developed this career, but it's about am I the murderer or am I the writer? And, you know, when we write personal essays, you know, it's a self-realizing, we do it for, we try to figure something out, right? We're trying to sort something out, I'd like to think. And with me, it was about identity, and it was about, you know, coming to terms, trying to apologize for what I did. But it was also about identity in the end. And, you know, who am I? Am I the murderer? Am I the writer? And, you know, I'm both. You know, I think we're a sum of all of our deeds, right? I think Bryan Stevenson likes to say, oh, we're more than the worst thing we did. I think that's I think he's encapsulating a lot there, right? I think when you are, you know, somebody that's, you know, stepped over that line and you've taken a life, I think, you know, and now I built this career for myself, that's a constant conflict, right? There's a lot of conflict with this career in prison, you know, but because in some sense you represent your peers, and sometimes you don't always get it right. You know, sometimes, you know, you kind of look at sideways by guys, and I get that. I get where that comes from, and sometimes they have a point. I learn from my peers, you know. So there's a lot going on with this, to your question. You know, it's more than just, you know, something to do. It's, you know, it's my calling.
That's WJFF's Patricio Rubio with a local edition podcast speaking to John J. Lennon. The full interview is available today at WJFFradio.org. Just click the podcast tab or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We'll have an excerpt from another one of our podcasts, Cooking in the Catskills, later in the show. But first, when we come back, passing on personal possessions politely. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week in This American Life.
What would be wrong with one channel that showed nothing but puppies acting the natural comedians and cuties that they are all day, every day?
After 25 years as a businessman, one man starts from scratch to create a cable network with this theme song.
Puppies, 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 puppies.
The cutest, fuzziest radio story on earth. Puppies, 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 this week.
Puppies, 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 puppies.
Saturday at 6.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The program Who Gets Grandma's Yellow Pie Plate is an extension program from the University of Minnesota, which provides people with practical information about inheritance issues of personal property, such as the yellow pie plate. I spoke with Bonnie Lewis, RN and dependent care educator at the Caregiver Resource Center from Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County. She, along with others, will be presenting this webinar on May 16th at the Time and Valleys Museum.
Everyone who has been cloistered in their homes and perhaps cleaning through their attics during our panic has come to realize we collect and have some very cherished items. And you now wonder, well, who should I give this to? Or, oh, my God, what are my kids going to do with all of these they have? And Barry and I included baseball cards or old baseball gloves or grandma's yellow pie plate. And Carol will share her insights into this along with me with the University of Minnesota's curriculum. It sounds onerous sometimes. You have all these things, and sometimes a crisis occurs, and you're thrown into, all right, now we have to clean out grandma's house. And there's also, so that's the side, oh, geez, and you dread it, and it can be cumbersome. But Carol and I also want to look at the nice side of it. This is a great opportunity to share history and memories and those cherished moments that I remember when I gave that to Grandma, this ceramic bust of Madonna you made in shop class in high school,
right.
And she always had it on that shelf. So this is a way for the curriculum, and Carol and I will go through being it's a sensitive subject with many families, how do you give away those objects and not hurt anyone's feelings? When you're passing things out, what is fair? And everyone has to decide how you want to do it. Is it everything's equal? Is everything equitable? You don't want to run into the conflicts that sometimes arise within a family when, oh, you got all the good stuff, you know, that old thing, you know, mm-hmm. when someone walks away with the things you thought you were entitled to or should get because you did X, Y, and Z for grandma. And it ends up your brother gets it because he's the oldest one in the family, say. So we go through it, and we're talking about non-titled property, those things that may not be in the will, such as collections of books or stamps, like and the pie plate, like I said. And we do go through those things that how do you give away the practical items, you know, is it listed in the will? Do you give it as a gift while you're still alive so you see the person appreciate that item? Do you make a big list? Do you have auctions? How do you pass it on to maybe a museum or art collection? So it's pretty comprehensive. You're talking about financial, legal implications plus the psychology of it, the family dynamics that gets discussed as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting part, the family dynamic. I think that a lot of folks, if they were to think about this, would think, oh, it'll be fine. You know, I'm on good terms with my family. But as I was reading through some of this information, there was a quote that somebody said, I never thought my sister would act like this. And it's because belongings have different meanings to different individuals.
Yes, exactly. And one of my favorite comic strips is For Better or Worse. And Lynn, the cartoonist, must have gone through this because very lately the cartoon strip is dealing with this subject exactly. And the mom asks her daughter, is there anything in particular that you'd like to have? She'll gift it to her now and enjoy it because the parents are downsizing. And she replies to mom, no, I've never really thought about it. But in her mind, oh, the rocking chair. Oh, the glass lamp. I want that. Oh, what about the old tea chest? And in the following cartoon strip, the follow-up is there she's sharing with her brother, and they get into a heated discussion. No, if you get that, I get this. Well, now you have that. I need this. So we don't want it to be contentious. We want to help those individuals plan ahead So it's a pleasurable, eventful affair. And I saw it within my own family when we met at my grandmother's house. You'll all of a sudden, I'll hear an aunt, oh, I forgot all about this. Oh, remember when Dad did this? And it was this ukulele, and they'd get around and they'd sing Little Grass Shack on Grandpa's ukulele. And they all broke into a song. And that's a great way of family all coming together and not finding it a hardship. That's the point, is we just want this to be an event that the person, the givee or gifter, finds it helpful through this curriculum on how to pass things on to whoever, not only siblings or extended family or neighbors or their favorite charity, et cetera, and that the kids may benefit if they're thinking ahead too, like, I don't want to get in an argument. I want this to go easy peasy, and it's going to be already difficult because you're talking about an end-of-life event sometimes, and hopefully not a crisis event, but you may be grieving, and if you can do your homework ahead of time, it makes it much more pleasurable.
And it is a curriculum. There's a workbook. There's a video. Why do you think it's important to have this structured in that way?
To get it out there and to talk about it. A lot of times this is more of an afterthought because it isn't in the will, it isn't in the title property. So if you actually can lay it out and talk about first what is the difference between titled and not entitled, and then go through, well, how are you going to set it up so everyone's happy with the end results, that they walk away feeling that they weren't slighted or whatever. You're prepared for if there is some family issues, you'll know how to hopefully navigate through that so that those conflicts that have already been there, they're managed and doesn't inflame a situation, any contentious. And the video is a short video on the creator of the program, and she realized when she was baking that it wasn't an ordinary pie plate. It very easily could have ended up in the trash, but she spent a lot of time in the kitchen baking pies, and that tradition of the holidays and that yellow pie plate, it all those memories she realized was that pie plate was a connection to her grandmother and special moments and seeing that apple pie baked. So we go through it step by step, and those that participate in Who Gets Grandma's Yellow Pie Plate, we'll mail it or electronically send it. We'll make arrangements that they can get the handouts, and there's some really nice ways to ask your kids, well, is there something that you're interested in? And my mother is actually using it, that there's the old tea set from her mother and milk glass and things like that. So my sisters and I have written down, well, we would, if possible, like this or this. And then it's up to my mom. Okay, she'll tease it out on who gets what. And some people just put masking tape on the bottom of things and say, okay, this is Bonnie's. Bonnie will get it back, which is one way people do it. There's several ways. But we'll get these handouts to them so that afterwards, after they learn from Carol and I, they'll find these tools to help them identify the special objects that they want to pass on. And also, it's a good way to document those memories because verbally you have said to Patty, oh, remember your grandmother used to feed your father with this three-sectioned antique plate. Well, Patty will remember it, but will her daughter? So if you can write it down, it's almost like a historical archive. Why is that item special? What's the background in it? And then you can put an extra column, who should receive it and why, and it's on one of the handouts. And then the kids can have their own list, which we do, the potential receivers of those special objects. They can write down what the item is and why it's special to them. What gives them or warm fuzzy, basically. And if someone else was to receive it, how would you feel? You know, so if my sister got it instead of me, it's a good way to get it out there and share your feed sometimes if people are comfortable doing that. A lot of times these come up during the holidays or when you're simply washing dishes. It's a good opportunity to talk about it. You're all of a sudden washing that yellow pie plate and it'll dawn on you, oh, I remember, I forgot about this. Actually, the other day I remembered my mom had a Tupperware container, Tupperware, and it's almost stained on the inside from the years of brown sugar chocolate chip cookies in them, but that was my father's favorite cookie. And I don't know where that ware container is stored because my father has passed away, so we don't eat the chocolate chip cookies as much. But I told my mommy, so that probably has no value at all, but I would like that chocolate chip cookie Tupperware container because I remember Dad enjoying his cookies and milk.
Yeah, that's important to you. And you mentioned like at a family gathering or a holiday, you know, if you're the parent or the adult child, what are some ways to start talking about this? What are some tips about talking about inheritance? Because people are reluctant to talk about this because it involves a loss of independence or death or end of life issues. What are some ways to start that conversation? Because it is so important to know where these things are going to be going.
I think if hopefully the person that has these special objects first has to know what their goals are when they want to transfer it. So you have to do a little bit of homework. Well, is the goal maintaining privacy, that when you're coming to that point where you want to pass on the objects, you don't want you want those objects to stay in the family, and why? Or do you want to improve the family relationships? You know, you want to bring the kids even closer or share your background and these memories. And how are you going to make sure that it's fair to everyone? Or do you want to contribute to society? So the giver needs to kind of know what direction they want to take and then all the other stuff that is meaningless to them. Then the kids have to decide, and you want to discuss this when everyone's well-rested and full with a nice belly of turkey or whatever. To come together, and you have to realize that conflicts may arise, and how are you going to talk about it without more of those conflicts? There's ground rules, setting up a location and a time to make sure no one gets excluded or forgotten, or at least give them the opportunity to participate when you're talking about it. A unique situation for every family, you know. And then, of course, we have the pandemic, and we also have children that live far away, that you FaceTime them or send them a letter that you're thinking about this. Is there something of a particular item that they're attached to that you'd like to give them?
It's practical information that will help folks communicate about this issue and make those decisions and lessen the conflict. We've been speaking with Bonnie Lewis. She's an RN and dependent care educator at the Caregiver Resource Center at Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County. She will be a guest speaker along with Carol Smythe, a Never Sink historian, and Dot Muthig, antique collector. And they will talk about who gets grandma's yellow pie plate, the issues surrounding inheritance and transfer of personal property. That's coming up next Sunday, May 16th at 2 p.m., a virtual event at the Time in the Valleys Museum. You can get more information about it at timeandthevalleysmuseum.org. Bonnie, thank you so much for talking to us today and for providing this information for families.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a great visit. And people, if you ever have any question about that, Carol and I also will be glad to give you more information if they contact the museum or me at Cornell Cooperative Extension. We have lots of information we can share with them.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Cooking in the Catskills is a podcast with Chef Brett August, available on WJFFradio.org. Chef Brett has appeared on the Food Network, and he ran some of New York City's finest restaurants, including the Breslin and Boulay. Now on his podcast, he's talking Catskills food and history. In his latest episode, he talks to Jake Freeling, who along with his brother Benji operate Benji and Jake's in Conneonga Lake.
As far as pizza-wise and appetizer-wise, what do you really love, enjoy making on the menu now?
I love making pizzas. My favorite pizzas are usually the more simple ones, just because you can really taste everything, you know? I really personally like to eat foods that are less ingredients, but, you know, I also enjoy sometimes someone will come up with a pizza that has like five or six toppings on it, and I'm you know, amazed by it. You know, it'll come out and I get that smell of all the different stuff at the same time. But I am a very simple eater, and that's actually what drove me to cooking in the first place. I don't like other people's food for the most part. As a kid, I lived on pretty much air and toast, maybe, you know, dry toast. You know, please don't put butter on my toast. That's way too complex. My boss at that bakery would laugh at me because she'd look at me after a 12-hour shift and she'd say, "What did you eat today?" And I'm like, "Oh, well, I burned a baguette over there. I was going to eat that at the end of the shift." She would look at me and say, "Oh, you burned that baguette on purpose because you like your bread burnt."
Is that because you guys were you eating? I just want to – just one thought I'm just so crazy about, because most people grew up with, you know, eating great food and, you know, that's how they got into the cooking experience. Now, did you – you know, why you didn't eat that much per se or whatever? It's because, you know, your mom and dad weren't cooking that much, or, you know, not a big family culinary background, or you just didn't really like food?
No, I'm obsessed with food. I just don't really need much to sustain myself, and I – love to prepare it.
I do too.
My earliest memories in life are standing next to my grandma Gloria in the kitchen on a stool, cooking, prepping, you know, picking and washing vegetables and herbs, and, you know, from the very beginning, she always trusted me next to the stove. I think I was maybe 2-3 years old when she first started having me help her out, you know.
Awesome.
And my family is like most Jewish families. When we get together, there's way more food than people can eat. We're all small people, you know. But my grandma loves the preparation. And it wasn't until years later that I realized my grandma never, ever ate. She just prepared and fed people. That was her thing. And I realized that that's kind of my thing too. You know, I learned from her. And, you know, I can go all day without eating anything, and then I'll have a slice of plain pizza, and that'll sustain me. You know, I do have a little bit of an obsession, borderline psychosis with food, because, like I said, you know, maybe it is a little bit of a disorder. I don't feed myself, but I'm obsessed with feeding other people.
You can listen to the complete episode of Cooking in the Catskills and past episodes with Chef Brett August at our website, wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a program note. Tomorrow, listen in for a special live edition of Sunday Stage at 7 p.m. For Mother's Day, we have legendary Catskills musicians Jay Unger and Molly Mason performing live. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. on Sunday Stage. We'll leave you with some of Jay and Molly. It's their rendition of Gentle Annie. Thanks for listening. Remember, be kind, wear a mask, and get the vaccine. And happy Mother's Day, Mom.
Comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York,
a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
Farm and Country is coming up next. Today's forecast, rain showers becoming more intermittent for the afternoon and a high of 49. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008. Proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.